welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Senator Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts recently proposed abolishing the Electoral College. She's among a growing cadre of Democrats still flinching from the outcome of the 2016 presidential race when Donald Trump won the electoral vote but lost the popular vote by some 3 million ballots. Warren, who is seeking the Democratic nomination for president, explained her logic during a recent stop on the campaign trail.
Well, my view is that every vote matters. And the way we can make that happen... is that we can have national voting, and that means get rid of the Electoral College and
We're talking about such prospects today, the pros and cons, and other ideas about how to change or eliminate the Electoral College. Ohio State political scientist Ned Fully is an expert in constitutional law and elections. His forthcoming book from Oxford University Press is titled Presidential Elections and Majority Rule. He joins us now. Welcome back.
Great to be here, Ann.
Let's start out with what the Electoral College is. I absolutely remember being taught about it when I was very young, but not understanding it. At all. It didn't make any sense because we're sort of raised with this idea of a popular vote. But that's not what happens in presidential elections.
Certainly not the whole story.
Mm-hmm.
So the Electoral College is designed to have us vote on a state-by-state basis. Each state gets a certain number of electoral votes. It's the same number as their senators and representatives combined.
Mm-hmm.
And the Constitution says that each state can decide the method for appointing the electors, because the electors are actually individual human beings that meet in December to actually cast the official ballots. Now, that's pro forma, sort of automatic that they do what the popular vote in the state wants them to do. But the Constitution has these people meet. But what's happened over time is that 48 of the 50 states have decided to let citizens vote what we call the popular vote, mm-hmm. and to say that all of the state's electors go to the candidate that gets the most popular vote.
In that state.
In that state. Not necessarily a majority. There's this distinction between the term plurality mm-hmm. and majority. Plurality means the most votes, but it could be less than 50% if there's three or more candidates.
Right.
And that becomes important as we think this through.
I wanted to ask you about what the thought, why does each state get to decide how electors are chosen? Because then we're not talking apples and apples. We're talking apples and oranges and pineapples because there's different ways out there, right?
Right. Well, this goes back to history, and it goes back to the sense at the beginning of the country that the phrase United States really meant United States, meaning it was a union of these separate states. And, you know, we're looking at Britain leaving Europe, Brexit. Now, the United States isn't that, but back in 1789, when they adopted the Constitution, they thought of Virginia and New York and Massachusetts kind of the way we think of Britain and France and Germany. In other words, the primary unit of government was the state, not the nation. And so they thought, well, if we're going to have this chief executive of this new federal system, that method should be very protective of the states as states. Now, as a country, since then, we've grown and become more national. You know, we've had a civil war, we've had the New Deal, et cetera, et cetera. But the Electoral College is a vestige of the past in its that it's so state-focused.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the history, the pros and the cons of the Electoral College, a new movement, not the first by any means. It's kind of sprung up in the wake of the 2016 election. My guest right now, Ned Fully, he's an Ohio State political scientist and an expert in constitutional law and elections. His forthcoming book from Oxford University, which is available now on Kindle, forthcoming later this year, is titled Presidential Elections and Majority Rule. If you have a question about the Electoral College, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. The Electoral College selection process is now, and correct me if I'm wrong, of course, largely run by political parties, right?
Well, the parties play a huge role, and that's especially true since the 12th Amendment, which most people haven't heard about, but it's actually what causes us to have our current version of the Electoral College. The original version adopted in the Constitutional Convention that gave us our Constitution was a disaster from by 1800.
Yeah.
Well, because they didn't anticipate political parties.
Oh, yeah.
They thought they could create a world without political parties. Well, that didn't happen. And so by 1796, you have Adams and Jefferson. And you think polarization is bad today.
Right.
It was as bad or worse
and
back then.
And vitriolic
totally,
to boot, yeah.
Totally. And so we could go into the disaster of 1800. It's fascinating details. But the upshot of it was never, they said never again. The Jeffersonian party came out on top, but it was a constitutional crisis. They knew that they were the majority party, and they said, we're going to rewrite the Electoral College to make sure that the majority party prevails, because there's going to be two-party competition. We can't have consensus. We cannot have George Washington, who is above party. So it's either going to be us or them, and it should be us if we're the majority. And so they rewrote the rules on that basis. But once again, it didn't work out the way they expected it to.
Because, of course, we have presidents entering the office without a popular vote.
Well, what they wanted was a majority president. What happened in the – it was Andrew Jackson after 1824. Another interesting story. But the upshot of that was that states adopted, without really understanding what they were doing, saying that – whoever gets the most vote wins. But if you have three or more parties, you can get this fragmentation.
Mm.
So so you actually have to get a majority of electoral votes to win. But you can get them. And what they wanted, the Jeffersonians wanted when they wrote the 12th Amendment, they said the only way you should get this national Electoral College majority should be by accumulating these state-based majorities. But they would be majorities at the state level. But in 2016, Donald Trump gets an Electoral College majority by winning states where he's less than 50%. So Florida, Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, he's under 50% in all those states.
Mm-hmm.
But he's getting all the marbles from those states. He's he's getting everything, even though more people vote against him than for him.
Because of winner-take-all.
Because of winner-take-all with a plurality.
Mm-hmm.
If it was a majority-based winner-take-all, if there had been runoffs in Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin, between just Hillary Clinton mm-hmm. and just Donald Trump, we don't know who would win, but it might have been Hillary Clinton because there never was just two candidates. We think of these presidential elections as red team versus blue team. There are only two candidates in the debate,
mm-hmm.
and yet it's Gary Johnson and Jill Stein that are making the difference. And
when they're close, they matter.
Exactly right. Exactly right.
Why was it etched into the Constitution instead of leaving it to Congress? Because it's hard to change, and that frustrates a lot of people.
Same with the U.S. Senate. I mean, there are reasons to think that we should have a constitutional amendment to get rid of the Electoral College and go to a pure national popular vote. If we did, I'd want to think about that it'd be a majority winner, that you shouldn't be able to win the presidency with just 38% of the nation's vote, for example. It would take a constitutional amendment to do that, and for the same reason that if you don't like other structures of our government, you need a constitutional amendment.
When the states say that winner takes all, is it winner takes all if they win the state? Or these 13 states that have changed, are they saying that all their electoral votes will go to whoever takes the most votes nationally?
Correct. So this National Popular Compact idea is to try to use the Electoral College mechanism to kind of do an end run.
Because they can't change the Electoral College.
Well, you could with an amendment.
With an amendment, but that's hard.
Right, very hard. Right. So this idea is if we get enough states to get to that magic number of 270 electoral votes, the majority, if enough states are on board, then we can control that 270 by going with the national popular vote if all the states agree. But again, that system calls for going with the plurality. So if you have a three-way split between Trump and the Democrat and Howard Schultz,
then how do you decide?
Well, what the proposal is for the compact is you'd go with the plurality. But think of the possibility. I mean, when Howard Schultz said a few weeks ago that he was thinking about running for president as independent, he's mm-hmm. the former head of Starbucks.
Right.
a lot of Democrats started to get very concerned that he would split the anti-Trump vote, that a majority of Americans would oppose Trump, but they would split between the Democrat and Schultz. Well, if you're concerned about that under the existing system, you should be equally, if not more concerned about that with this compact idea. Because if, say, just assume that, let's say the split works out, that Trump gets 43%, the Democrat gets 42%, Howard Schultz gets 15%, then Trump wins the national popular vote with only 43%. But if you suppose that in a runoff, the Schultz supporters would have said, we're anti-Trump first and foremost. We like Schultz better than the Democrat, but we prefer the Democrat to Trump. Then you've given the election back to Trump with only 43% of the vote when a majority of the Americans strongly opposed him.
Democrats are behind much of the current push to end run the Electoral College and or abolish it, as Elizabeth Warren proposed recently on the campaign trail. But both parties have been troubled. It all depends on who's on the outs at the moment, right?
Exactly. I mean, we should be able to, as on a bipartisan, nonpartisan basis, get a good system that is good for all Americans. I think that's the goal of my scholarship, and I think that should be the goal
of
the system.
You shouldn't be checking your party at the, you know, at the door.
Right. Right. One party shouldn't impose its will on the other party. And the phenomenon that I was just talking about Trump getting an Electoral College majority without a majority of the popular vote, that was true of Bill Clinton. If you think the system isn't working, you shouldn't just point to 2016 and 2000.
Right.
You should point back to 1992 with this three-way split between Bill Clinton, the first George Bush, and Ross Perot.
Right.
Because the only state that Clinton won with a majority was his home state of Arkansas, as well as the District of Columbia. Every other state that he wins the electoral votes from, he's winning with less than 50% because of the split between Perot and Bush.
As Ross Perot famously said, the devil's in the details, and that is no less true with something like the Electoral College. It's not simple. It's complicated, but it's something that Americans really need to know about. My guest right now is Ned Foley. He's an Ohio State political scientist, also a law professor. He's an expert in constitutional law and elections. His forthcoming book from Oxford University Press is titled Presidential Elections and Majority Rule. We're going to talk about his idea for how things could change coming up in the program. We're also going to hear from another expert in electoral politics, or the Electoral College, I should say. So stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
I'm Mike Thompson.
And I'm Steve Brown, and we are the hosts of Snollygoster, WOSU's podcast all about politics in Ohio.
Each week, we chat about what the shrewd politicians at the State House are up to and how national politics affects us here at home.
Find out why listeners have called us a weekly must-listen. For a lighthearted yet in-depth look at Ohio politics, subscribe to Snollygoster wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about the Electoral College, its history, and the pros and cons and proposals to change it or abolish it. Still with us is Ohio State constitutional law and elections expert Ned Foley. His forthcoming book from Oxford University Press is titled Presidential Elections and Majority Rule. Gary Gregg is a political science professor at the University of Louisville and author of the 2001 book Securing Democracy, Why We Have an Electoral College. He joins us by phone. Welcome to the show, Gary Gregg.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Gary, the Electoral College has been criticized as broken and archaic system. And what's the evidence for that? What do people point to?
Well, I think people point to the general idea that one man, one rule. should govern American democracy. That I think it's kind of a simplistic idea of democracy, but that's what it's looked like. I mean, as far as archaic, well, it's no more archaic than the entire constitutional
right.
order, and we have updated it. It's changed. It's evolved over time. So the archaic argument doesn't really fly with me very, very strongly.
Yeah, and some people, you know, I guess there's the question of it. Whether it's working or not is in the eye of the beholder still, or not necessarily?
Sure. I mean, it works in the sense that it gives us presidents. And that's pretty good. And most of our presidents, I think we look back, would say we're pretty good presidents. It's given us pretty good presidents, and it's given us presidents. It's gotten us through some very tough elections, some very close elections. I think we can't ask for a whole lot more than that. But of course, if we think it's broken, it's generally because our candidate doesn't win. And so, you know, we tend to look at something. It's something that's been rigged or something's kind of wrong if our candidate doesn't win.
Yeah. Ned Foley.
Yeah. So I guess I see things a little bit different in that I think, the Electoral College has evolved in a way that it's working inconsistent with those in 1803 and 1804, wrote and adopted and ratified the 12th Amendment, which I think gave the Electoral College a different vision than the original convention did. And for a while it worked. But as soon as this system of plurality winners at the state level came into effect after the Andrew Jackson, it went awry from what I call the Jeffersonian vision of majority rule. And the first election of that nature was 1844, which I never learned about in high school, but turns out to be one of the most significant elections in U.S. history. And one of the reasons why I want to bring it up today is it's one where we don't have any horse in the fight or the dog in the fight. In other words, we're
so far ago.
Right. We don't even remember who was there. But it was the two main candidates were James Polk and Henry Clay. And James Polk was much more pro-slavery. Henry Clay was much more anti-slavery. But there was a third candidate from the abolitionist party that was completely anti-slavery named James Birney. And New York was the swing state at the time. And Birney took enough votes away from Clay to give New York to Polk and therefore the whole Electoral College to Polk. And that really changed the course of American history, because Polk was manifest destiny. We're taking Texas by force, even if Texas, you know, Mexico doesn't want to give us, and so on and so forth. It was a huge election with historical consequences. It was the Electoral College, but not the way the Jeffersonians envisioned it. But the defect was not in the Constitution. The defect was at the state level to let Polk win New York instead of Clay winning New York because of the presence of this third-party candidate. Mm. It's that same problem that causes Ralph Nader in 2000 to be the reason why Bush wins Florida instead of Gore and for it to flip. It's the same problem that lets Ross Perot be the effect that he is, and for Jill Stein and Gary Johnson to be their effect in 2016. So that's what I think we should focus on as what's wrong today.
It's ironic, is it not, Gary Gregg, that in part established the Electoral College because they realized that the party system was going to rule, but they didn't envision these third party candidates coming up and upsetting the apple cart.
Yeah, well, the original Electoral College did not assume the parties
right.
at all, and parties are a significant part of the problem with it. But third parties, actually, I think it's exactly the opposite of what the other guest just said. The Electoral College is an argument. Well, there's a serious argument for the Electoral College by looking at the rarity of third parties actually being able to control an election, to switch an election. We pointed it to 1844, 1992. But the serious argument was put forward first, I think, by Daniel Patrick Moynihan, Democrat senator from New York, when this was being fought. We fought this battle in the 1970s. And what he argued was America actually naturally has a four-party system. And you think about it, it just makes sense. You look at the races. We have a more left-wing, let's say Bernie Sanders, part wing of the party, and we have a Hillary Clinton, the moderate wing of the party, and we have a Ted Cruz wing of the party and the Republicans, and we have a John Boehner, I don't know, maybe middle of the road, sort of more middle of the road party and the Republican Party. It's the plurality system that brings the parties together so that there's not an incentive for the more radical wings to stay in the fight. So you have to imagine you throw the Electoral College off and you say all you got to do is win one more vote than anybody else in the nation. What's the incentive at that point for a Bernie Sanders or a Ted Cruz or whoever to say, okay, well, I'll go home and I'll rally around these people that I don't really agree with. It's an argument, and I think it's a pretty serious argument made by others since Moynihan, for the stability of our system, because it forces two major political parties to sort of moderate most years. Not in 2016, it didn't work that way, but most years, both parties sort of moderate around two candidates who can win places like rural Ohio, where you are, and can win maybe in some places like either Texas or New York or Philadelphia or wherever as well. That's pretty good for our system.
Yeah, I guess Gary and I are going to have to disagree on our analysis. And, and political scientists do debate this, that there is no perfect electoral system. Mm-hmm. Arrow proved that with Arrow's theorem. But I think it's important to distinguish between ideal theory on the one hand and what our system is. And one thing that is absolutely true from the historical record is the founders wanted majority winners, not plurality winners. So to say that the Electoral College was based on that plurality winning is better, that's exactly opposite to what the historical record says. And then another election to point out where you can have major three-way splits is 1912, where the Republican Party broke in half between the incumbent President Taft, who was opposed by Theodore Roosevelt, who had been president and who didn't like what Taft was doing. And that creates a huge three-way split between the two Republicans and Woodrow Wilson. So we don't actually have a system that's well-designed to do what Gary wants, which is to take four ideological groups or five or whatever and to winnow down to an actual winner. The assumption was that you would have a two-party system, and that's all that you needed. The advent of third parties and minor party candidates in the 19th century has caused a wrench in the system.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. That's Ohio State constitutional law and elections expert Ned Foley. Also with us, Gary Gregg. He's a political science professor at the University of Louisville and the author of the book Securing Democracy, Why We Have an Electoral College. If you have a question or comment about the Electoral College, give us a vote. Give us a vote.
There we go.
Oh, it's the end of the week. Give us a call, 614-292-8513. Or email us at allsides@wosu.org. And Andrew in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Andrew.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I guess I just had a quick two-parter question for your guest. It seems to me that the two-party system, from my perspective as just an average American citizen, is really just a division in our country and is really only a source of division between the American people. It doesn't really seem necessary to me. Now, I'm not an expert in political matters and by any means, but it seems to me that Republicans and Democrats, the whole two-party system seems to just be a way to divide people.
To sort us out, you mean? Like sort us? Okay.
Yeah, to just separate people from different walks of life. And I was wondering for your guests, I guess first part of my question is, do you think that it's relevant or important to continue to have a two-party system rather than just an American, an American party? And if we got rid of the two-party system, how do you think that would affect the Electoral College as a voting structure?
Gary Gregg?
Yeah, so I think in the ideal world, I think the entire constitutional order is based on a world without parties. I just talked about this in class yesterday about how the party system really throws out Federalist 51, separation of powers, et cetera, really undermines that. So in the ideal world, yes. On the other hand, in the world that we know with human beings, I think parties are natural. As Madison said, factions are to liberty what air is to fire. If you're going to have freedom, you're going to have parties.
Okay. Yeah, Ned Foley?
Yes, the only thing I'd add to that is to say that government exists when there's disagreement. And so you ultimately have to decide whether the majority is going to prevail or the minority when there's disagreement and there isn't consensus. And generally speaking, it's better to have majority rule than minority rule, because if you believe in equality, more people are satisfied with majority rule than minority rule.
Now, and there are the courts to mitigate or temper.
Exactly. You have to protect individual rights through the Bill of Rights and constraints on. We don't want majority tyranny. We don't want minority tyranny. But as to those issues that Democratic legislatures and Democratic government's going to decide, it's better for the government to reflect the will of the majority.
You know, and Andrew, thank you for that question. I appreciate it. Gary Gregg, you know, you mentioned you're teaching in a classroom right now. Do you find your students and the general public more attuned to this topic these days than they have been in the past?
Oh, yeah, I think there's no question. I'm a little surprised by it right now. I mean, obviously, we talked a lot about it around 2016, right after the election. And I'm a little surprised of how much it's popped up.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure how much the average person is thinking about it out there, but people that are politically engaged are seeing it because it's become, particularly on the Democrat side, it's become a pretty serious Elizabeth Warren, et cetera.
Right.
And, of course, they have the National Popular Vote Movement that just had a vote in Colorado in favor of it. So it's out there, but I'm not sure the average American is concerned that much. Let me say one quick point about Ned's point about majority rule, though. Mm-hmm. is our entire political system, that's what we want to talk about, majority rule now, but our entire political system, if you read Federalist 10 or Federalist 51, either one, is based on controlling majorities. Majority rule is likely to be factious rule against minorities. And so this Electoral College is part of that elaborate system that does not say let's give majorities the rule and let majorities rule, but it is let's have sort of concurrent majorities. Let's divide up the majorities so that you don't have a majority that will crush the rights of minorities.
Well, I think we agree in part in that respect, because I think the concept of concurrent majority is important. Again, the reason why I wrote the book that I did is I think to understand the philosophy of the Electoral College that governs us, it's not enough to look at the Federalist Papers that was about the original Constitution, but instead to read the debates in Congress, which are much more voluminous, actually, on the 12th Amendment in light of the experience of the development of the two-party system that occurred in 1796 and 1800. It's incredibly interesting philosophical debates where they discuss all of these issues anew in light of experience. And they talk about protecting minorities from majority tyranny, but they want the presidency to be a majoritarian institution understood in a federalism way. So they designed the Electoral College to have just what Gary talked about, a concurrent majority where you get the Electoral College majority by accumulating state-based majorities, not pluralities. And so the deviation from the system, which was not part of the Constitution, comes decades later, is not concurrent majorities anymore. It's accumulating these pluralities at the state level. But that's antithetical to what the system was supposed to do.
We have a caller, Patrick from Columbus, who is raising another point that I think, you know, lends credence to the whole idea that none of this occurs in a vacuum, that you can change everything you want, but whenever you change one, it's like the butterfly effect, right? So, Patrick in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi.
Yes, hi, Ann. I wanted to ask your political scientist if they see our government becoming more of an oligarchy. Money is too influential in politics today, and corporations may contribute unlimited funds to political campaigns. And so the will of these billionaires is being done in our Congress because they have so many of our political leaders in their hip pockets.
Well, and it also changes the money in politics, also changes the very nature. I don't think that the founding fathers anticipated how money would play such an important role in everything when it comes to politics. Ned Foley?
I agree with you.
Yeah.
Yeah. I do think we have to think about that issue long and hard, and it's a difficult one. And I agree that all the components of the system are interrelated. But money, actually, relatively speaking, money affects presidential elections less than congressional elections or local elections because presidential candidates get so much more free media time. And the debates have such a – that's not to say that money is less important, but if my memory serves, you know, Hillary Clinton raised more money than Donald Trump did, and, you know, that didn't mean that she wins.
Yes.
He had a lot of free money, right. And they both had a lot of free money, and the debates matter. So I think it's a complicated subject. Money, I think, plays a particular role in the primary process, you know, especially as you have all these candidates on who wins the so-called money primary, even before the voters
vote. The news
vote.
Of who raised the most money is bigger news than who's running right
now.
Yeah,
so I think that's a place to look at the effect of money.
The tie in the money electoral college, I think this is, I won't weigh in on the oligarchy stuff, but if you're concerned about that, I think that's another great defense of the electoral college. Where does the money come from? It comes from overwhelmingly from cities and suburbs. Where are the massive amounts of votes that would come if you would throw off the Electoral College and just went with a plural national popular vote? They're going to come from the same place, from cities. Where is all the media centered in the United States? This may be breaking up a little bit, and I apologize for your show. I realize it's centered differently. But they're centered in the same places. So I think one of the questions I think that the Electoral College does, or one of the great things the Electoral College does, is it gives a little bit of bonus to the rural areas, the small states, the small places. It takes a little bit of that centralized power that comes from the major urban centers that contribute so much money and so much influence over our elections.
Ned, you've written about the prospects for a hybrid sort of the popular vote and what you call ranked choice voting. What are you talking about there?
Yeah. So again, if there were a constitutional amendment, you could go to a national popular vote where all the votes in all the states are put into one big combination. Just add them all up, whether they're in California or Delaware. But I think you would only want to do that if you had a mechanism to guarantee a majority winner, because you wouldn't want somebody winning in a five-way race with only 26% of the vote. So you would need some sort of runoff system. You could have a regular runoff the way other countries do and just come back 2 weeks later, a month later, and pick among your top two finalists. Or you could use what's called ranked choice ballots, where you have all the candidates listed and you rank order your preference, or at least you have the option for doing so. So if there is a third-party candidate on the ballot that you like, you could put that person as your top choice. But then if there's a major party candidate that's decent enough as your second, you can put them as your second choice. Mm-hmm. And that guarantees, you know, more cohesion, again, majority rule.
More logical reflection of the public at large. Gary Gregg, I know I have to let you go, but what do you think about that idea?
Well, I think I won't say exactly what I think exactly about that because I haven't thought about it enough. I have to read Ned's book when it comes out. But Ned's right, and I applaud him for realizing how, as so many people don't that are fighting in this battle right now in this space, how complicated a replacement would be. You would have to have some kind of a runoff. It may be some kind of a system like Ned's developed. It may be, you know, a runoff like, 2 weeks later have to come back. I think, do any of us actually want to have a runoff election? I think probably not. I think it's very complicated, and I think any kind of attempt to change the Electoral College has to come up with some new solution that is not simply, one more vote than the next person, you get to be president.
Gary Gregg, thank you so much for your time today. I appreciate it.
Okay, thank you.
You bet. Gary Gregg, political science professor at the University of Louisville and the author of the book Securing Democracy, Why We Have an Electoral College. That's what we're talking about today, the Electoral College. It's not top of mind, but it's more of mind than it has been in recent generations. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about the Electoral College, its purpose and history. An Ohio group recently withdrew its effort to amend the state constitution to allow for Ohio's electoral votes to go with the popular vote. Organizers have promised to return. In the meantime, the proposal has sparked interest in the Electoral College and its role in presidential elections. Still with us is Ohio State expert in constitutional law and elections, Ned Foley. His forthcoming book from Oxford University Press is titled Presidential Elections and Majority Rule. And by the way, you can get it on Kindle already. David Leland represents District 22 in the Ohio House. He's also former chair of the Ohio Democratic Party. He joins us by phone. Welcome back.
Hey, Ann, how you doing?
Good, thanks. And John Koza is chairman of the National Popular Vote. That's a nonprofit that studies and educates the public on the prospects for a national popular vote. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ann.
John, you've been working to get the national popular vote in place since the early 2000s, and I'm wondering how the 2016 election changed the roadmap for you on that score.
Well, the 2016 election caused a number of Republicans to be a little less favorable to the idea of a national popular vote. Previous to that, we had been accumulating substantial Republican support. Our bill, the national popular vote bill, had passed the Oklahoma Senate and passed the Arizona House with two-thirds of the Republicans and two-thirds of the Democrats sponsoring it, and had substantial support in other states. It's been harder after the November 2016 election to get Republican state legislators to vote for the bill, although some have.
Because they figured, hey, the pendulum has swung in our direction.
Well, and in fairness, the Democratic state legislators, when Obama was in the White House, a number of Democratic states were reluctant to adopt national popular vote because there was a prevalent feeling during the Obama administration that the Democrats had a permanent hold on the White House, a so-called blue wall theory. So both parties go through these phases of thinking that the system is permanently rigged in their favor when, in fact, there's no convincing systemic argument that favors either party.
David Leland, when did you jump on the bandwagon of changing to a popular vote system?
Well, I had the opportunity to meet Dr. Koza back in 2002, and we became friends. And then later on in 2009 or 2010, before I became a member of the legislature, I started working with him to promote the National Popular Vote Compact because I felt that in this country, the person with the most votes should be the person that gets elected president. So this started for me several years before the 2016 election. It was even actually before the 2012 election that Barack Obama won. I think it's not about Democrats or Republicans. Mm-hmm. It's about a principle. Do you either believe that the person with the most votes should be elected president, or you don't? And I happen to believe that in order to sustain a strong republic in this country, we need to have the credibility and the confidence of people. And I think that the confidence and credibility of the person holding the highest office in the land is only enhanced if we make sure that that person has the most popular votes when they get elected.
We were talking earlier about Ned Foley's, my other guest's, proposal or our idea of a hybrid of a popular vote and what's called ranked choice voting. I mean, John Koza, you think going strictly to a popular vote just strictly is the solution, or do you envision some kind of combination?
Well, our group doesn't envision any combination. Mm-hmm. We elect governors, U.S. senators, and virtually every other public official using the first-past-the-post system. But the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact is completely compatible with ranked choice voting. And there's even a possibility as early as this year that the Maine state legislature may apply ranked choice voting to presidential voting in a manner that's completely compatible with the idea of a national popular vote.
Ned Foley?
Yeah, John, I'd love to hear more about that because I haven't been able to figure out the logistics of that. It seems to me, I mean, I definitely understand how you can use ranked choice ballots on a state-by-state basis so that the state of Ohio, for example, doesn't give its electoral votes to a candidate unless they get a majority using the ranked choice system. But I don't see how you can get a national ranked choice vote unless all states use ranked choice ballots, because you can't compute on a nationwide basis the rankings if only a few states are using ranked choice ballots and the rest of the states are using traditional plurality-based ballots. So I'd love for it to be possible, but it seems to me that you can only combine a national popular vote and ranked choice voting with a constitutional amendment. You can't do it through the compact idea, at least not that I've been able to figure out.
Well, first of all, we don't have a majority requirement under the current system of electing the president. There's no state requires a majority of the votes to get all of the state's electoral votes, and there's certainly no requirement nationally for a majority. So introducing the requirement that the president have a majority of the vote is quite contrary to the way governors and U.S. senators, congressmen, and almost every other office is elected.
Well, many,
But to get to your technical question, there's only one state that uses ranked choice voting now, and it's only for members of Congress, and that's the state of Maine. So there is simply not support at the moment for ranked choice voting in all the states. What the ranked choice voting people, FairVote, the leading group, has said in Maine is that if a second state passes ranked choice voting for president, all the states that have ranked choice voting at the time, that is the second state in Maine, would pool their votes and do a ranked choice among those states. But it's impossible to go from one state to 50 states quickly.
Well, I appreciate that. Here's the problem that I have with going to a national popular vote without building in the ranked choice voting is, as I mentioned earlier, and using the current example of Howard Schultz thinking about being an independent candidate. And this is not a partisan point because it could affect either party depending upon the dynamic. But if you have a third party candidate splitting the vote, you could have Trump winning 43% of the national vote, the Democrat winning 42% of the national vote, and Howard Schultz winning 15%, where the Schultz supporters don't like Trump and would have voted for the Democrat second. But as you say, unless there's a majority requirement, the compact would give it to the plurality winner, which I think is not consistent with democracy, because it would be another example of minority rule, not majority rule. And I do think it is true that many states use plurality elections for governor. Not every state hasn't always been true. Some states still have some forms of runoffs, but the Electoral College itself was built on the requirement that you get a majority of electoral votes. They thought about letting it be a plurality of electoral votes, and they said, no, we want majority winners. And I think for a good reason. I think the country would be dissatisfied, or should be dissatisfied, if somebody wins with 43% of the vote, where the sense is that, you know, way more than 50% really didn't want that person to win.
Well, you're mixing up two entirely different things. A third of our presidents have come into office without a majority of the national popular vote. Most recently, Clinton in both terms, George W. Bush in 2000, Trump in 2016, and any number of previous presidents, Nixon in 68, Truman, et cetera. So you're merging two totally separate ideas here, which is that we don't have a system of majority requirement to get elected to office, except in, I think, Georgia, perhaps, and perhaps Louisiana. We have a plurality system. And the problem of a George Schultz influencing a presidential election exists under the current system. After all, we had Ralph Nader tip Florida to Bush and hence the White House. And we had Johnson and Stein taking away enough votes to have probably elected Trump in 16. So you're raising an objection to national popular vote that exists in the current system.
David, okay, go ahead.
Yeah, so I guess these two guys are both a lot smarter than I am, so I'm going to let them continue that discussion. From my perspective, it's a simpler thing. You know, we have a federal system. We elect United States senators. We elect members of Congress. There are elections for the United States Senate and for Congress where there's more than one candidate, and sometimes the people that get elected to those positions aren't elected with a majority vote, but they get elected to represent the people in their districts and in their states. We should be doing the same with the president of the United States. The person who gets the majority of the vote is the person who should be president of the United States. Maybe it's not perfect. Maybe we can kind of tweak it to do something better. But it's certainly better than what we're doing right now, which is where we have a system where somebody who can get, in the example of the 2016 election, can get 3 million votes less than the person who actually gets put in the office of president. And that's just a devastating effect on the people, on the population, on our democracy, on the viability of the person who's sitting in the Oval Office. So there are a lot of ways you can kind of tweak this, and there's all sorts of constitutional restraints and issues and whatever. But I think fighting for the concept of the person who getting the most votes being elected president, to me, is the most important thing, and that's what I'm doing.
Yeah.
So I think it's misdiagnosing the problem. I agree with John. The point is that it is absolutely true that the problem of plurality winners exists with the existing system as would exist with the national popular vote compact as constructed. But the way to fix both problems is to do state by state, especially in the pivotal states, the requirement of majority winners. And in fact, for the reasons that John said, if the key states of Michigan, Wisconsin and Pennsylvania had insisted on majority winners, his hunch and my hunch is that the Electoral College would have aligned with the outcome of the Clinton's plurality at the national level, because the reason why the Electoral College goes awry currently is because of these plurality-based results, like Ralph.
More than two candidates.
So the better fix in the short term to get what the will of the majority actually want is to implement majority requirements at the state level. The long-term fix by constitutional amendment can be to combine a national popular vote with the ranked choice or the majority requirement. But in the short run, you can't have both at the same time. And the more urgent necessity is the majority requirement.
Dave Leland, how do you think this flies in Ohio? The group that was, stepped back, that was going to be collecting signatures to get it on the ballot. How do you think Ohio voters respond to this issue?
Well, I mean, Ohio has historically been a battleground state.
Right.
That may or may not be changing. I mean, once upon a time, the state of California was a battleground state, and that obviously has changed in the last few years. So that kind of designation is very, very fluid. But I think Ohioans right now are still thinking of themselves in that capacity, and so are used to being visited hundreds of times by presidential candidates. That mm-hmm. may be a plus or a minus depending on who you are, mm-hmm. but they sort of like the attention. So I think Ohio is a little bit more difficult than maybe some other states to work it. But you know, these ideas take time, mm-hmm. and that's why I've introduced this piece of legislation. This will be my third time that I've introduced this legislation in the Ohio House, because these concepts take time. It takes time to educate people on what we need to do and how we need to move forward. So I think that, ultimately, I think we can be successful in Ohio, but it's probably going to take a little bit more work than it might in some other states.
Well, David Leland, thanks for joining us today to talk about it. I appreciate your time.
Thank you, Ann.
David Leland represents the 22nd District in the Ohio House, representing part of Columbus, and he's former chair of the Ohio Democratic Party. Also, John Koza is chairman of the National Popular Vote. That's a nonprofit that studies and educates the public on the prospects for a national popular vote. Thanks for joining us today, John Koza.
Well, thank you, Ann.
And Ned Foley, Ohio State University expert in constitutional law and elections. His forthcoming book from Oxford University Press is titled Presidential Elections and Majority Rule. Ned, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, Ann.
And thanks to everybody else for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. I want to thank the All Sides staff, producer Mary Lee Williams, assistant producer Kyle McKinnon, the All Sides interns, Ray Brewster, who produced this show. Thank you, Ray, for your work. Maisie Glockner and Sophie Warner with video production by Rich Blue and Amber Blue. All Sides with Ann Fisher is on 89.7 NPR News.